It says we're live. I can only assume. Oh, look at that blurring effect. Good evening, everybody. How's everything going? What a week. Can you, at the very least, this week's newsworthy events, there was some political stuff in there, but other than that, there was some massive stuff that we can all, I think, discuss freely and without risk of upsetting people or ruffling feathers on YouTube. Yeah, a crazy week. It's been just one madness week after another, and we have some material for tonight. How is everybody else out there doing? Gideon, I just read your message. Let me see how, if there's an answer to it. I hope your mother's okay, and I hope this is the frustrating thing. People no longer have any form of free mobility to travel. I have siblings in the United States who haven't seen my parents who live in Montreal in, it's a year now. It's a year. I got siblings in Toronto who have come in periodically, but this might be a good time for me to start with my rant. I'll do my rant before I do the disclaimer so that I can also segment this part in a future highlight for tomorrow. For those of you who have not seen my Viva on the Ice rant from this morning, I actually caught three fish. I caught three fish, which if you put them one in front of the other, might have made for the smallest fish you would have ever caught ordinarily in summer. Three tiny perch. But it was a 15-minute rant, vent, meandering discussion about what we have witnessed over the last year. When this lockdown first happened, and I remember I started doing what I was calling therapeutic streams, you know, just checking in to see how everybody was doing. And at the time, I was like, I don't want the channel to turn into a coronavirus channel. I don't want the material to turn into strictly dealing and complaining about coronavirus lawsuits. You see, I covered issues from time to time. I covered the Quarantine Act. Then I started covering certain issues that arose, certain lawsuits. I didn't think this was going to turn into a year. And I remember I had a tweet, which probably hasn't aged well, from back in March when I said, you know, at one point, we're all going to be able to exhale again. And it's going to be like the light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. Like, wow, we just got through that, thinking it would be a month. And in today's meandering discussion with myself on the ice, I was just, you know, reminiscing, going over, you know, what we've witnessed over the last year. And as far as I am concerned, the willing abandonment of any sense of rights of the citizens, basically an abandonment of any respect that we once had for whatever rights we thought we had. And this is the interesting thing. Rights are nothing more than respect. And the funny thing is, once you start thinking you have no rights, or you have no inalienable rights, or you have no fundamental rights that cannot be messed with, but under the most egregious circumstances, with the most thorough justification, and the messing with which has to be the most minimal possible. Once you stop thinking that, you basically stop having respect for yourself as an individual. And it was a quote that I used in one of my vlogs from this week, Ayn Rand. There's no smaller minority on earth than the individual. And so you cannot respect civil rights unless you respect the individual rights. I may have mangled it. I may have actually made it better. So you know, I'm reminiscing and seeing, you know, people on Facebook not only not lamenting, but relishing, saying, yeah, of course we should go into lockdown. Of course we should have, you know, our rights are basically privileges that can be taken away without any justification seemingly whatsoever, without any legislative process, without any check and balance, indefinitely. And people who have been now put into a position where the fear of the absence of restrictive measures is almost greater than the restrictive measures themselves. And I'm just started from the beginning. 2-week lockdown to flatten the curve while the government adapts and responds. That was the emergency. We're a year into it, and instead of the measures getting more lax, at least in Quebec, they're getting stricter. We're now in month two of the shutdown of non-essential businesses, and we're nearing the end of 1 month of curfew, which our own health director says, you know, is no concrete scientific evidence that it has anything to do with preventing the spread of the virus. And it's more of a wartime measure to make sure there's no nighttime riots. And, you know, what drives me nuts, and then it'll get into this ad that our Premier Legault just tweeted, we had time to prepare. And it seems that the government's response, which was deficient from the beginning, it is now for the citizens to bear the brunt of that. From the beginning, in Quebec and Canada, at least, something like 80% of the deaths and the cases, if not more, originated in long-term healthcare facilities. When the government imposed the lockdown, what ended up happening is that the employees were limited and they were circulated from one long-term healthcare facility to the next. So the infected employees would in fact go from one healthcare facility to the next and spread the virus there, which is why they were decimated by the virus. And it's a government response and it's a result of a government response. In the meantime, we've had 10 months to prepare for this. What has the government done? For those of you who've been following the channel, you'll know not much as far as I can tell, but they found $13 million a month for COVID advertising awareness. And then today, Legault retweets an ad, which is the Canadians team throwing jerseys at people saying we're all in the same team again in this fight. We're all on the same team. Except quite literally, certain members of our team can't play hockey at night anymore without a fine, whereas others are making millions. And at the end of the day, with all of this done, we get a jersey for all of our troubles. That's the idea. That's the tone-deaf nature of this ad. And you have the discussion, and then it automatically turns into this demonizing of, oh, you don't take it seriously enough. You want grandma to die. I mean, this is what everybody says so that you can't even have a sensible discussion about it without being demonized and turned into something of an extremist on this. And whereas the issue was always never you want granny to die, but you want to make sure that the decisions you're making are not only going to not protect granny, but going to result in grandkids dying. And people send me articles, people send me studies, people send me, you know, stuff dealing with all the incidental but highly predictable tragedies resulting from these measures, which have been more or less effective, I think we can all say, and we have these ads rubbed in our face. We're all on the same team. We're all in the same boat, except some of us are in the boiler room and others are on the yacht, on the deck, taking the sun. Okay. That was my intro. So we'll see where this goes. I never thought we'd come to a point where people would absolutely just willingly relinquish the most basic fundamental civil liberties in the absence of compelling justification and compelling need to do it. And people think that it's, you know, it'll go back to normal. Yeah. Okay. You missed the real bamboo. It's 5,756 super chat just on time. I'm going to bring up some of these chats. When is Viva depressed? Viva's depressed. It's getting serious. I'm not depressed. I'm distressed because it is all about taking the proper measures, not just random measures. And now the numbers are going down in Quebec. Apparently the hospitalizations are going down from 1400 to lower than that. Who was it? Lewis Carroll. When you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And I said this from the beginning. It's going to be one of two things. The result's going to be the same. Either the curfew, which our doctor says has no scientific basis for being effective, is going to do something, or something's going to happen, or nothing's going to happen. If something happens, good, it's working. Keep it in effect. If nothing happens, make it even stricter because it's not working. So it's motivated reasoning. It's motivated political reasoning. I'm not depressed. I'm just a little frustrated. Got to vent. I've got to express it and then have these commercials rubbed in our face. Here's a jersey. We're all on the same team together, except we get to play hockey tonight and you can't leave your house after 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tommy Stewart says it would be cool to start an organization that checks on people's relatives in other countries since we can't ourselves. And then I get discussions like this. People who are abroad, whose parents are in Canada, or people whose parents are abroad. And you can't travel now. You saw the restrictions that they're imposing in Canada. It is rules that are only going to penalize the least fortunate and the most vulnerable. And those with the means are always going to find a way to pay for them or pay their way around them. Remember, it was to flatten the curve in 2 weeks. Good times. I remember it. Okay. So with that said, now that I've missed a bunch of super chats, Gideon Roos says, I got the WhatsApp just now. Damn Washington delivering late, but she sent them several hours ago. If she's fine, she's asleep now and won't answer for several more hours. So I have no clue. Oh, Gideon Roos. Jeez Louise. Okay, I got the WhatsApp just now. Okay, let us know. But this is the thing. Things happen with family and you cannot be there. And to get there it would probably take you less time to actually take a ship across the ocean. Now, if you come into Canada, for those of you who don't know, and I guess I'm doing a public service announcement for the government, you need to get a test upon arrival. Pending the results of that test, you need to go to an approved hotel facility for upwards of 3 days, pay for your own accommodations, which apparently the government says should cost $2,000. I've stayed in a lot of hotels in my day. I've never stayed in one that was $600 a night that I know of. We travel light, but $50 to $100 for us was expensive. So there's that. If your test results is negative, you still have to go back to your house or wherever you're staying in quarantine for 2 weeks. And if your test results is positive, you apparently get relocated to a designated quarantine facility. Okay. Can we hear say Barnes, I am gorilla? We'll see. I don't know if he's going to say that, but Lionel de Grandpre says hospital capacity. Doug Ford's response, 10 months in, capital city of Canada got a tent with 40 beds, cost $16 million. It's like, it's, you don't have to have the answers to be able to know when things have not been done properly. And again, like my issue is it was never a question of throwing grandma to the wolves. I have had loved ones, and elderly loved ones with underlying comorbidities above the danger age have confirmed cases. This is not a question of throwing the vulnerable under the bus. It's a question of actually protecting the vulnerable while letting the able do what they need to do to keep the system going. Okay, so now let's just see. I see Robert is in. He's looking dapper yet again. So I'm going to say the intro caveats. Thank you all for the super chats. I'm not going to get to all of them. If I miss them, don't. And you're going to be miffed, don't give the super chat. It makes me feel guilty, and I don't like feeling guilty. I have a very guilty conscience. Not confession through projection. That is just OCD, something, you know, other where you end up obsessing over the negative stuff. If you're going to be miffed, don't give it, but thank you very much for the chats. And I'm just going to read a few that I missed. Kangaroo says, I am poo-flinging gorilla ape, together strong, GME, I love stonk. I don't know what any of that means, by the way, except I know that has to do with GameStop. David Nachsen Albright says, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. They have that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. I've been getting flack because I'm saying inalienable, and some people are saying it's unalienable. I think either works now. Then we got Mario Ragu says, the numbers are going down because they have changed their testing requirements to confirm cases thanks to the WHO politicizing healthcare to kiss up to Biden. Okay, and we see here Mickey the Fourth, check 200, cool. Says, if you want to take your mind off of the serious stuff, I can offer my appearance on this channel, Radical Libertarian, about Czech politics. Since communism fell on February 4th, it is an excellent channel about economics and geopolitics. The channel is called Radical Liberation, not Radical Libertarian. Sorry. Thank you very much, Mickey. Okay, with that said, I think I missed a few here, but I'm doing my best. And sometimes my best is not good enough. Okay, and by the way, other standards, nothing legal advice in here. Overt threats are the only thing that get flagged and removed, and I suspect the community reports overt threats. Spamming, there are a few spammers in there. The Russian sex bots get blocked because they offer nothing. Even some of the spammers still offer something. So I tend to leave spammers alone, but if it gets to be a nuisance. Okay, Sean N., the only person who made any effort to increase bed capacity just left office. And we got Kevin Kvulchuk. Why would you need to quarantine if you are negative? The whole point of taking the test is to prove that you are not infecting others. No comment because I know when I get out of my realm of reasonable knowledge. First time here for live. In US, I cried over this on March 16th, and then I got busy. The FTM 22. All right, people. With that said, oh, yeah, nice cracking tonight. Robert's looking good. He's smiling, and he looks like he's over the weather than he was under last week. Let's bring him in. Let's see what's going on because we have material to get to. Robert, how you doing?
Good.
Everyone's going to ask. Let's get it out of the way right now. What are you smoking?
Oh, this is a limited edition H. Upman Magnum 50. It comes in these little cases that you get that keep them in good condition.
All right. Now, and someone else. So now you have your cigar for the week. Someone else messaged me and asked what the book behind you in this stream was. And it was the title on it says History of the United States.
It is William Appleman Williams, The Contours of American History. It could be that one, or it's the Charles Beard's History of the United States. He also wrote The Economic Roots of the Constitutional Convention, showing that what was happening there. So he was one of the great populist historians back from the 20s and 30s.
Okay, excellent. And now I want to just bring, I can't bring the two super chats up. I just want to read them. Troy Thompson says, don't you think Manitoba is the test project? Quebec is most likely to protest and riot, just like France. If these COVID measures work in Quebec, all the rest of Canada will follow. Jason McConnell, thank you very much for the super chat, and sorry I can't bring it up. I'm not Dr. Tam, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night and the night before and before. Dr. Tam, for those of you who don't know, is our chief doctor thing for the government, who at one point said, if you go to protests, because you have the right to go to a protest, don't scream, just bang things together when you're gathering en masse. Another absurdity that she said was, wear face masks when having sexual intercourse, and you might want to focus on positions. I swear to you, this is actually said. You might want to focus on positions that don't have a mouth-to-mouth. Robert, we're living bizarre times. Okay, we got a lot to talk about tonight. So let's start with the most obvious. I think it was actually the number one on the poll that I ran in community in YouTube. Biden losing to Texas, Texas winning over Biden. So for the we discussed it briefly last week. Texas Attorney General filed suit requesting an emergency TRO, temporary restraining order, basically to suspend Biden's suspension of applying federal immigration law, suspending deportations, and the rest. That was one of Biden's, I think, what's he up to now, 70 executive orders or 40?
It set a record. I know that, Martin. It was an anticipated ruling for two reasons. One was because of all the precedents that have been set by the people attacking Trump over the past 4 years, where they expanded judicial power and judicial prerogative to interrupt or interfere with presidential executive orders, even as to matters of foreign affairs. So they're reaping what they sowed. The second part of it is that there was one of the smarter moves of the Trump administration on the way out was to contractually agree that they would go through certain protocols and procedures before they unleashed and opened the border, knowing that this would, in fact, hamstring Biden. And so that's a separate basis by which they could bring their action. Of course, also here, Biden is short-circuiting the entire internal regulatory process of notice and comment, which, again, Democrats were the ones to elevate and escalate the significance of in their attacks on Trump's executive orders, which were far fewer in number. And so just on those three bases, the court made the kind of, frankly, the obvious ruling. It was going to take a heavily politicized, openly hypocritical ruling to go the other way, given where they've been ruling the last 4 years. And so it was not a surprise that he lost. I think it was a surprise, though, to some people in the Biden administration for whom they were just accustomed to winning, believing, you know, to the people who are born on third base and think they hit a triple. There's a lot of Democratic lawyers that are on that side of the aisle and did not realize what they had set themselves up for. And so and the Fifth Circuit has been stronger in this situation. And they didn't buy the standing and other arguments because it's clear Texas is directly prejudiced by opening up the border and not deporting those who have already been ordered to be deported. So given that they had a very as strong a legal claim as you possibly could. Very smart case. Once again, the best populist state actor is the Texas Attorney General. He has been throughout this entire process, and he continues to be.
Now, the question I had, did anyone look into the judge? I mean, if we want to look for the political potential explanation of the judge, do we know who appointed the judge, who the judge was?
I don't. I didn't look at that. I didn't. Well, the ruling came down so quickly, I didn't go any further into it.
And I was going to do it. I meant to do it before, but I had too much other stuff to cram up on because you gave me a lot of homework this week. One thing. So first of all, does it go to appeal or do they just craft a new executive order, which is sort of a two-part question? Am I not understanding it correctly that they can potentially just abandon this lawsuit, redraft another executive order, word it differently somewhat, and then require the Texas AG to go back to court to contest it again?
They could. If they're smart, they'll try to go through the internal notice and comment process. But they may appeal it to the Fifth Circuit. They can do so. Could take it all the way up to SCOTUS. But the Fifth Circuit has generally not been overly predisposed toward the government on some of these kind of questions. It's not a friendly circuit from a Democratic perspective. Obviously, the Supreme Court, they would anticipate, given its 6-3 majority currently, that they're not likely to prevail there either. And so just rewriting an executive order wouldn't solve their problem. And so it was a big loss right out of the gate. It was a big gamble and it backfired in a major way. And it may put into a set of dominoes into motion that may hurt them in the other areas where you have the folks in the oil industry, bringing a petition to review to challenge what happened on the Keystone pipeline. There's probably coming challenges to the CDC's mask mandate that are derivative of Biden's executive order as well. And so I think they've set things into motion that could harm them in the judicial system. They've been presuming the judicial system would be entirely aligned and allied to them because of how often it had been during the Trump administration, and they're discovering otherwise.
Okay, interesting. And so the decision effectively is, I mean, in a way is a legal no-brainer, where you have the executive effectively saying we're not enforcing the laws that the legislative approved of, and we're not doing it by way of executive order.
And we're going to ignore the notice and comment requirements, and we're going to breach our contractual agreement with the state involved. So it was the weakest claim. It was the most vulnerable claim for them to have tried to start out on. And it's evidence of the lack of forethought and foresight on the Biden administration's part that they stepped into it so quickly, so easily.
And so, I mean, I guess the issue would have been, but for this decision, the practical effect would have been exactly what the executive order dictated. This would have been effectively an executive order acting like legislation.
Exactly. And doing so in a context that not only did...
let the jokes in the comment section begin, Robert. You slipped into my...
Yeah. Not only does it do that, but they also just went at it in such a way that they had the least... I don't think they really planned on how to defend this and how they were going to succeed defending this, because of the way they defended themselves in court, how quickly they lost, they didn't appeal it right away. All of the signs were the signs of them just rushing something through. And in particular, it was problematic because you have these caravans coming up from Central America that think that Biden's executive order means they have 100 days to get to America and get free citizenship. So it was a major loss for Biden's administration right out of the gate that could have a detrimental domino effect, and definitely undermines the entire media legal left theory of the last 4 years, which is, oh, only Trump does these rogue things. It also reminded everybody what Biden said during the campaign, which he said a president who rules by executive orders is a dictator. And then he just set a record for the number of executive orders by any president, a record set of time.
It is, if anybody knows in the comment section how many it's been, I believe it was, it's either 40 or 70. I know that by all accounts, it's a record for anybody. The substance of these executive orders, I mean, how many of them are, I will say, over the top from a legal perspective, but how many of them are, you know, totally questionable? How many of them are just guidelines that they're issuing for future legislation or for future administration action? What were the more egregious ones above and beyond the immigration executive order?
The one where he had the most authority but had the most immediate detrimental impact was the Keystone Pipeline one. But he had broad discretion in that area. So though there is a range of legal challenges coming to him, they're uphill battles. Probably the most problematic one after the immigration one, there's some ones about gender and critical race theory that are going to become problematic, but they haven't been institutionally implemented yet for impact. The one is that he issued a bunch of executive orders that asked for other agencies to issue mask mandates. And the most questionable one now is the CDC came up with a very broad mask mandate that basically they're trying to expand their jurisdiction and authority in ways that had not been done previously. Basically, all forms of public transit in the entire country, the CDC claims federal authority over. That's by itself extraordinary, and solely pursuant to the executive order by President Biden for them to do so. His fraudulency the second, for all those who don't know.
Robert, I was just going to say, you referred to him as President Biden. It was a show of respect.
Yes, but it has to be limited. We have to recognize his rightful title, his fraudulency the second, after his fraudulency the first, Rutherford B. Hayes. But the CDC is, not only that, they're doing this double mask stuff. So one of my favorite memes was that the next thing Biden administration is going to come out with is just do saran wrap around your head, you know, about 40 times. You might suffocate, but at least you'll keep that scary virus away from you. Well, this is way beyond. I mean, they exempted, at least they recognized they didn't have control over private vehicles and private Uber vehicles, but public, and they even assert authority over taxis. So this is going to be challenged. The question is where it gets challenged. And in the utility of it is the scope and scale of it is so broad. You can challenge it on grounds other than whether or not you don't have to prove to a court that the mask mandate is isn't justified on scientific or medical grounds, though I believe such you could incorporate that kind of challenge. But the other component of it is here you can challenge it because it's done by executive order. It's not done by legislation. They did no notice and comment period. The whole point of a notice and comment period, it's derogatory to the constitutional legislative power. But the theory is that the executive branch can kind of replicate the legislative process from a due process perspective by saying, here's what our rule is going to be. We're going to invite a lot of comments and then allow and before the rule goes into force. And that's a multi-month process. They short circuited that entire thing. The left used that tremendously against Trump in the census context and a range of other contexts. Well, if it's going to be fair play, unless the courts all want to embarrass themselves as utter hypocrites, which even federal courts have a problem doing it this quickly. You know, it's like Woody Allen's joke, tragedy plus time equals comedy. Well, for the court, hypocrisy needs time to look okay. And so you can challenge it on notice and comment grounds. You can challenge it on other grounds along those lines, similar to the way, and you can use the Texas decision as part of that predicate, because that was part of the premise for the Texas court decision to challenge it. And I think it will be challenged rather soon. You can also challenge it that CDC just doesn't have this authority in this many places. They're trying to make it a crime. They're trying to claim that the CDC now can criminalize whether or not you're wearing two masks, even if you don't, even if you've already had COVID and you now cannot spread it, even if you've had a test that shows you don't have COVID, doesn't matter. You got to have two masks on if you're going to use public transit. And by the way, who does this disproportionately target? It's poor and working class people. They're disproportionately imposing these rules on. So I think there's ways to challenge this because of its scope, ways to challenge it because of the lack of administrative process. It's the Administrative Procedure Act that governs these things, in part the notice and comment component. So I think that's coming, and that'll be a good, useful challenge to have. And maybe it can open the door to challenging some of these other mask mandates that are going far afield, which don't frankly have the degree of medical certainty behind them that they're propagandist would propose. And best and part of the evidence of that is why were they scared to do a notice and comment period? I mean, what was so afraid? I mean, aside from the time rush is the excuse. What were they nervous about? They couldn't justify this, maybe?
No, the time rush now, it's going on a year where masks have been, they've been saying what they've been saying about masks now for at least 8 months. So, and I do want to specify two things. I get a bunch of emails after some of our streams, Robert, where people disagree with you, and they seem to come from, say, call them medical professionals. And I'm not saying that to be disrespectful. I'm just saying I have no way of vetting any email that I get. But some people disagree with you strongly on the masks and some of what you say. And I actually just want to specify that when Robert says this, my impression, and I think I'm not wrong in reading it this way, is these are the arguments you would raise if you go to court. And so these are not... This is not a lawyer pretending to be a doctor for everybody out there. This is a lawyer saying, if I'm taking this case to court, these are the arguments I'm raising, and this is the evidence and the studies I'm going to raise. And it'll be up for a judge to determine whether or not it's compelling enough. But these are the arguments. So I want everyone to appreciate that this is not a lawyer playing doctor, which is like the old joke. What's the difference between God and a lawyer? God doesn't think he's a lawyer. So I wanted to you know, open that parenthesis.
And here there are two other issues. So independent of whatever you think of masks and their utility and efficacy, for which clearly there's controversy. Just go back and look at what they were saying in February and March of last year. All the mainstream media was bashing the idea of masks. Did the science really radically change within a few months? So that would be my open question to those folks. But there's additional problems on the mask side. It's just, why are we requiring it of people who have already had the virus? Why are we requiring it of people who have been tested negative? Why are we requiring it of people who are asymptomatic? Because now there's more and more evidence that there is no massive asymptomatic spread, as was falsely alleged. So it's who's being required to wear it. That's also a problem, aside from whether it's effective, period. But putting that aside on the mask efficacy, do you want the CDC to be able to regulate your local town hall? You're supposed to, on these kind of decisions should be governed by your local government that's most responsive to you. It should not be the CDC. So the problem is the degree, the scale, and the scope. And where do you think this ends? Do you think this ends? Even if you believe in masks, do you believe the CDC should have this power? is a major, is the big question. And then a secondary question to that is whether they went through the proper process in the first place to even institute it. And then last is whether the masks are effective or really required for health purposes. The hard part is I've been explaining to people about challenging masks other than challenging them in the disabled context where it's discriminating against people who can't wear masks, is that the courts love masks. So if you show up in court, you're going to have a bunch of masks on. So it, you know, there will be an uphill battle convincing judges that the white lab coats don't have it right here. But there's plenty of evidence that from an evidentiary presentation perspective that it isn't. And my belief is if you had both sides present their experts, an independent jury that came in with no bias would decide that the masks do not meet the constitutional standard for coercing it and compelling it on people. No problem people wearing masks. I'm not telling people not to wear masks, whatever you want. My view is freedom first. And that's the main objective here.
And this has been my position from the very beginning is without requirements, without legal requirements everywhere, I think you'd get upwards of 90 some odd percent participation because people have no problem doing it by and large. Where people start to take issue with it, as is the case in general, is when the government starts making it legally mandatory. Then people start pushing back more than they probably would have in the first place.
And we've already seen it's disparately hurt the discriminated against the disabled all across the country. They've been mocked. They've been humiliated. They've been attacked. They've been verbally attacked. They've been socially attacked. They've been denied and deprived services, denied and deprived access to education, denied and deprived access to employment. So we've already seen the detrimental effect and impact of coercing and compelling this on the broader culture. It disproportionately falls on the least able to protect themselves for people who are already exempt under the law from having to wear it in the first place. Aside from the, I'm just not a big fan of medical Sharia law, you know, so I'm just not a fan of it, period. If you're right, you should be able to use persuasion to get people to do it. And as you know, 90% of the people do so if they're persuaded of it. If you're wrong, it's only when you're wrong that you really have to compel and coerce people to do something because you weren't able to persuade them. And if you weren't able to persuade them, you shouldn't have the backdrop or the back second option of being able to force that medical Sharia law upon them.
Now, I want to read one chat, which I don't want to look like I missed because of the substance of the chat. Nimitz, N-I-M-I-T-Z, says, 2 million have died to COVID already. 220 plus million will die by the end of the year from starvation worldwide if we don't stop letting crops rot in our fields. First super chat. That was not the message I thought it was. I didn't get to the second half. I thought the person wanted me to highlight the importance of the global statistics. But yes, what the powers that be now say is that there's going to be hundreds of millions who will die from starvation as a result of the interrupted food supply chains because of the lockdowns. What we've seen already in Canada is a significant number of increase in opioid deaths, overdoses, which was already high in Canada in the first place. We've seen everywhere a massive surge in suicides. And I have not yet gotten to this lawsuit. I'm not sure if I can, but I'm going to try to get to it. A parent of a kid who committed suicide is suing, I believe it's the local government or the state, for the death on the basis that it was the result of the psychological abuse of these lockdowns. It's you know, and the question is, you know, asymptomatic spread, the degree to which there is this asymptomatic spread, the degree to which the masks are efficient for the type of precautions that are being used for. But yeah, then the other absurdity is the measures that the police go through to implement the forced mask mandates. You know, I said in one of my videos, I don't condone or encourage people to break the law. When looking at the way the police are reacting, it's like the legislation now is not just the fine that the police can issue, it's coerced application of the law on the spot. Even if the measures that are being used, given the rationale, are totally paradoxical, counterintuitive, totally hypocritical almost, to pepper spray someone in the face or to have six officers tackle them because they're not wearing a mask because the rationale for the mask is not to spread the virus. It gets out of hand quickly, and it's V for Vendetta type behavior that leads to a bad situation. Cell says, persuasion is key. Had a guy ask me to wear a mask while at my own desk. No explanation. When I said no, he lit up and threatened to call management. All right. So anyways, that's the important caveat for what Robert's saying is it's people may not like what Robert's saying, But if you don't, and it's the same thing with Dershowitz, if you don't have lawyers defending positions you don't like on the principle of those issues, which are fundamental constitutional principles, it's only a matter of time before no one's doing it. And then you're going to find that it's not face masks that are the issue anymore, which you had an issue with. It's going to be something that you actually think is wrong and nobody's there to defend you. So what is next for Biden executive orders? You have the mask mandate, which we'll see where it goes. I took the super chat on that one. We've seen the Texas lawsuit. Nothing else on the horizon, nothing on the immediate horizon for lawsuits.
The other claims that may be coming down the pipeline will be implementation on the gender issue, whether gender identity can just be included within gender definitions, because it really undermines Title IX. The Obama administration waged war on Title IX in its own way by creating sort of the campus rape hysteria, moral panic that led to a deprivation of a lot of people's due process rights. In that context, they're doing it again, but they're going to wait to see once someone's injured by the implementation of the policy. Same with the critical race theory that he's greenlit again, which is being challenged. I'm one of the lawyers who's volunteered to assist with a group of lawyers who are contesting that across the country. Once it's implemented, lawsuits already been filed in California and Nevada and elsewhere, challenging when it's been implemented in schools, because it's clearly open discrimination. And you have a Biden administration, people like Susan Rice going out there saying they're going to openly discriminate based on race and gender. That's not what our 14th Amendment allows. That's not what the Fifth Amendment allows. That's not what our civil rights laws allow. So once they're implemented, we're going to see that contested. And we know the lack of popularity of it, because when they put it on the ballot in California, it failed. Even California, it failed when they tried to allow open racial discrimination and open gender discrimination. So those challenges are coming, but they're awaiting the institutional application of these executive orders.
All right. Very interesting. Let's move to one subject where I think we might disagree. We were messaging back and forth about this one earlier in the week, and it is the arrested for a meme situation. Ricky Vaughn is his fake name. Douglas Mackey is his real name. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the story, I covered it earlier in the week, but even my wife doesn't have time to follow all of my content. Douglas Mackey, 38-year-old Trump supporter, back in 2016, was making memes. Now, I happen to think the term meme is being abused in this context, where there's a difference between memes and deliberate misrepresentation. Memes typically have a punchline, which is more than just deceiving, but we'll get there. So Douglas Mackey, back in 2016, leading up to the election, was messaging with a group of friends and talking about how they're going to make a bunch of memes to try to effectively joke about when the election date is and means of voting. Now, it was based on the indictment, the internal discussions among friends, where they were deliberately trying to mislead people to vote by text or on social media. And so they went out on a campaign with a series of memes saying, stay at home, vote from home, something along those lines, you know, like, or vote by text. Text the name of the candidate to a certain number. Other details which are more or less relevant, but Douglas Mackey's first Twitter account was shut down. He opened up another one, shut down, opened up another one. Bottom line, by the end of this, apparently 4,900 people texted into this number to text in their candidate for the vote. Apparently 99% of the people who texted it in did so after Mackey's memes. Now, the issue with the meme is that it looked like a legit campaign image. The issue with the meme, as far as I'm concerned, is at the bottom of the image, it had small print, which was a disclaimer, not available in Puerto Rico, Guam, wherever, paid for by the Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign with the what I think is the official H logo. Now, Robert, I know your concerns, but express your concerns in the abstract without this particular meme about where the, is it the DOJ or where the prosecution is going with this type of criminalizing of speech.
So there's three issues with this indictment that I see. The first is selective prosecution. So as one of our local subscribers noted, there were people whose tweets are still up, unlike these tweets, where Democrats were advising Republicans of the wrong, Trump supporters of the wrong date. And they were more effective, frankly. They were more liked, more retweeted, more shared. and appeared to be more legitimate because it was a person in a Trump hat looking like they're at a Trump campaign headquarters saying this event. That person hasn't been prosecuted at all. None of the people involved with it have been prosecuted at all. And so you have very selective prosecution, and the First Amendment does prohibit selective prosecution. That's problem number one. Problem number two is venue. As will not be a shock at all, this prosecution comes out of New York, this time just the Eastern District, right across the river. And basically, and it, even though none of the defendants, and not the main defendant currently, they list other co-conspirators that haven't indicted, none of them reside in the Eastern District of New York. None of them did this within the Eastern District of New York. The only tangential connection is that a few people who live in the Eastern District of New York texted responses to it. And on that basis, they're bringing an indictment. This is an abuse of the internal protocols and procedures for venue. Venue is supposed to be prosecuted where the defendant is or where the defendant transacted the activity. It's a constitutional abuse of venue because venue is supposed to be done in the jurisdiction in which you reside primarily. That's its principal objective, or where the crime took place. Because under this definition, anybody could prosecute anybody as long as there's any tie or connection whatsoever to that jurisdiction. And I don't know if Democrats have woken up to this, because someday there may be a Republican with an IQ over 50 that will be a United States attorney that will say, maybe I'll prosecute Hillary in the Northern District of Alabama. Maybe I'll prosecute Obama's administration in the District of Idaho. Then you'll see bloody murder screamed out by the legal and media class saying, oh, this is venue abuse. So the problem is, again, who's making the decision? And this is, in my view, both the constitutional, statutory, and internal rule violation. The third problem is, once you start criminalizing speech, and once you start getting, for example, one of my favorite questions in this context is to ask people, is there any state or federal law that prohibits you from committing fraud in the election context in terms of voters or appeals? There isn't one. So fraud is commercial fraud. Other things can be an exception to speech. There is no law that criminalizes it. And there's a reason for that, because every member of Congress knows they could be prosecuted under that statute. Because did you lie about your opponent ever? Could someone claim you lied about your opponent ever? Did you mislead anyone ever that could somehow impact what they did or didn't do or could have impacted them? There's no limits to this. So historically, the only time they've even looked at prosecuting, and by the way, for this statute, the criminal statute they're prosecuted under was originally designed to deal with Klan violence. That's why it reads the way it does. It doesn't have the word fraud anywhere in it. It talks about threatening, intimidating, harassing. And it was meant when the Klan went around and stopped people from voting. And so to analogize a meme on Twitter that there's several problems. One, it got like a few hundred retweets. The people retweeting it are all wearing MAGA hats.
Well,
you can see right in the tweet. That's, by the way, you notice they didn't include photos of the tweets. They had no problem doing this in other cases. They didn't do it here because they knew someone would look at that and say, who in the world would be fooled by that? And the question is it a meme? And I was trying to make fun and say, this is how dumb Democrats are. Someone would believe something like this. Or is it meant to truly deceive or get people into doing something? And again, there's no federal law that prohibits deceiving people into not voting. It's only if you threaten, intimidate, harass. This doesn't meet that definition, in my view, anywhere close. Historically, the only case they've even looked at is in every election cycle. People do calls. People get emails. People get direct communication that tries to get them to vote a different way or not vote or exercise their right to vote. People are usually when they even look at this, it's somebody who sends out something that looks like a government mailer right to their house that misleads them about when to vote or where to vote. Even in most of those cases, they don't even look at prosecuting. And when they do, they prosecute much less than this. So in my view, a meme cannot be criminalized at this point under our existing laws. There are speech problems with doing so. I agree that when you go over the line of trying to mislead people, you may be outside of free speech protection, but that doesn't mean you're inside of the federal crime for intimidation, threat, or harassment.
And that is one of the more legitimate points that I probably should have gone into more detail in the vlog, is that, yeah, I'm saying that my position was, I think they crossed the line with the official disclaimer from the campaign and reproducing the logo, which made it look like an official campaign logo. So we're not in meme land anymore. We're in, you know, I would call it fraud land, in that you are purporting to represent officially a campaign that you don't represent. Whether or not anyone with half a brain should know that that was a joke is another thing. setting aside the fact that older generations are not necessarily as aware of these things, and they can be easily duped into thinking you can now vote by text, because I think one day you will be voting by text, at least with thumbprint recognition. So the actual specific crime itself may be a stretch. It may be not the right crime to go after them. The selective prosecution, no one's going to have to convince me that there is selective prosecution. And this is going to be the good segue in when we get to Kleinfeld versus Manafort or Roger Stone. No one's going to have to convince me about the selective prosecution. That is a very big problem. And my issue is not that Douglas Mackey should be punished harder everyone should be punished too hard. It's that everyone should be punished fairly and equally. And we don't see that happening. And it's not for reason of not looking. There is selective prosecution. There is selective acquittal. So you raise a number of good points. I guess the better point might be, if it's not that infraction that they were accused of, intimidation and whatever, might it be covered by another potential violation?
Well, they would have brought it if there was. And the reason for this is you can see where this line gets really scary if you start to criminalize, quote unquote, fraud in an election. In other words, not fraud that happens at the government in terms of counting of ballots and ballot processing, not that kind of fraud. But if you start saying, if you do anything that's, quote unquote, fraudulent, that, quote unquote, could, quote unquote, impact an election, you can imagine what can start to get criminalized. Pretty much every politician could get locked up tomorrow, but all kinds of ordinary people could too.
Well,
and that's the danger of it.
Some politicians can get locked up tomorrow. And if the prosecution is as weaponized as what we've seen over the last 4 years, we know which politicians are going to get prosecuted and which ones are going to get a pass. And having seen what the courts do, we'll know which ones are going to get a pass on condemnation or sentencing, and which ones will get the book thrown at them.
And that's why we've historically limited it to action, to conduct, not anything that's really speech at all. In other words, things that's threats, intimidation, harassment. That's not what this meme doesn't fit any of those. And if memes start to, if they're going to expand that definition to mean those things, then anything, I mean, any speech could be interpreted that way. Any comment could be interpreted that way.
If they have an Uncle Sam wants you to vote for him, that might be intimidation to vote for him, because of what it might imply. No, so all very fair points. I did find it not just curious, that's a pretentious word. I found it suspicious they didn't include the actual graphics of the memes or the tweets.
And notice what else they didn't include. They didn't say one person didn't exercise their right to vote because of it. They just said a bunch of people responded to the text. I guarantee you they followed up and saw whether anybody actually didn't vote because of it. And I guarantee you if there was anybody that did, they would have included them in the tweet. They would have had a nice narrational story about how tear-jerking it was. They found apparently zero people who this actually impacted their exercise to vote. It wouldn't surprise me if it turns out a lot of those people were in on the meme.
That was my other question, my other observation, which we'll find out later. Some people were joking that of the 4,900 people who voted by text, there might have been people who thought if you could vote by text, I'm going to do it multiple times and then I'm going to go vote in person. So they might have done all of them. So they might have done all of them thinking that they were exploiting the system for whatever the reason. What happens now, practically speaking? Do they raise all of these defenses or preliminary measures, or do you just go to trial and raise them at trial?
Well, I mean, the hard part for this, I mean, they picked on a little guy. I think he did this when he was in his 20s. I mean, it's also peculiar. They waited for Trump to be out of office to do so. My guess is that the U.S. attorney at the Eastern District of New York recognized these problems under the Trump administration and said no. And as soon as he was gone, they decided to rush through the indictment.
When he could no longer be pardoned, had they brought these charges beforehand,
and,
I presume.
And not only that, just they couldn't hear a no. In other words, they couldn't have the U.S. attorney say, I declined to bring this indictment. They wait till he's gone. They run down to the grand jury and get it real quickly. And so the problem is he's a little guy. He's probably got very limited resources. So he's going to have some public defender who probably hates him and hates his politics. So that's why this is a very dangerous path that they're going on. They picked on somebody big. Okay, I would at least respect that aspect. They picked on a little guy they could make bad law with. And that's what's, the morally problematic part of what they did.
Oh, and just so that nobody criticizes me, it was not an indictment. It was a complaint, an affidavit, and I believe it was approved by a judge and not a grand jury. So even I would say, dare say, maybe better for some and maybe worse for some. This was actually approved by a judge. I mean, the dude was arrested.
You could blow a leaf across a desk and they'd sign most things a prosecutor asked them to.
So that is the Douglas Mackey situation. I it's not a question of being a limiting free speech Canadian who has no respect for First Amendment rights. I do think you cross a line when you at least as relates to fraudulent misrepresentation. Whether or not this crosses that line is one thing, and apparently it might even be an academic distinction on my part because the charges are not for fraud. The charges are for something else, which, like Robert explains, historically have never been used for these types of purposes.
I mean, well, why not bring an indictment over some of the biggest Hollywood bigwigs and other people who threatened loss of employment if you supported Trump, threatened social shaming campaigns? I mean, that's actually a lot closer to threats and injuring and harassment. Do Democrats really want to go down this path? Do they always assume the courts and the prosecutors will be in their pocket? The Biden figured that wasn't quite the case in the Texas case. So this is a high risk gamble they're going down, but they're willing to do so. I mean, it's a piece and part of all they're doing. Let's indict presidents who are no longer let's impeach presidents who are no longer presidents. Let's expel members of Congress based on a crazy interpretation of the 14th Amendment. They're weaponizing everything with no sense that it could ever blow back on them. These are dangerous, perilous precedents that they're setting that are a threat to constitutional freedom and real democracy in the country.
And you made the joke, and now I'm thinking Chelsea Handler saying she was going to cut off her ex or grant. I guess that might be extortion to some because Chelsea. Okay, for anybody who doesn't know, Chelsea said that she would either do something or not do something if 50 Cent would vote for Trump, and I believe she was using weaponizing sexuality to change a vote. Speaking of the weaponized political process, we've covered Douglas Mackey. We're going to come back to it because there will be news in it when there is. Do you know who's representing him, by the way? Sorry.
I don't think he has. To my knowledge, I mean, if he had counsel, it was probably just a public defender at the bail hearing. But if he gets a crazy judge like the chief judge of the District of Columbia, then who knows what could happen on that context. But but right now, I don't know of who's representing.
Okay. So let us say, speaking of weaponizing of the prosecutorial process and the exculpatory process or the sentencing process, Kleinsmith, perfect segue, Kevin Kleinsmith, everybody, not Kleinfeld, Kleinsmith, which had me asking, first question, Robert, did Carlito die at the end of Carlito's Way?
Ah, good open question. Most likely, yes. But a great film for everybody. I mean, Kleinfeld is a classic. Kleinsmith makes Kleinfeld look like a beacon of ethics in terms of legal practice. To reference our first cinematic reference of Carlito's Way, Last of the Puerto Ricans, as Al Pacino starts out with. What happened there? I went back and looked at our Kleinsmith sentencing show and our Kleinsmith show 6 months ago and predicted this. So predicted one that Kleinsmith, the way that plea deal was structured, meant Durham was going to do nothing, took a lot of crap from it from certain people. That prediction turned out absolutely correct. The second one is I predicted as soon as the sentencing memo was put down, it said he's going to walk, said most he'll do is a week or two. And what happened? He walks. So here's a guy who lies. Who not only lies and creates a perjured affidavit before the FISA court, where the only protection is that those officers won't lie because there's no adversarial process in the FISA court because it's all done in secret and only one side gets to present evidence and argument, but forged documents, got caught red-handed forging documents that led only to the disaster of Russiagate writ large and what it did in terms of foreign policy, what it did to the Trump administration, but what it did to Carter Page individually, who had to fight to testify as a victim in the case and detailed the horrendous impact it had on him and his family financially, in terms of security, in terms of the emotional impact on he and his family. And the judge's reaction, one of the judges who was fooled and tricked because he sat on the FISA court as a part of this process, which raises questions about his role in it. And he allowed, first of all, he allowed Kleinsmith to claim he really didn't commit a crime all the way through sentencing. It shows the open hypocrisy of this. He should have been denied his plea if that was the case. It shows what a joke Durham is, that he allowed him to say those things. That should have been hammered him. I mean, I represent ordinary people that if they can test a single little thing in the plea, the judge and the prosecutor crucify them. And I mean, I'm representing an ordinary guy where they want 5 years in federal prison for a minor tax issue. And this Kleinsmith is getting to walk. So one, he gets to deny he really did anything wrong. And then secondly, he gets straight probation. Less of a sentence than George Papadopoulos got. Papadopoulos just got a few things wrong in recollection to the feds. He wasn't someone who was misusing and abusing power to target an individual, wreaking extraordinary harm institutionally and individually. And you see what the system really thinks, particularly in the District of Columbia, where he gets to walk and never serve. He gets to write articles for some liberal publication. That's his sentence. While contrast it to what happened to the guy who had the gall to put his feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk for being accused of nonviolent crimes, not a drug-related, not gang-related crimes, who the magistrate in Arkansas said this guy's not a threat to flee, he's not a threat to the community, said he absolutely has a constitutional Eighth Amendment right to bail, right to the bail under the Bail Reform Act, and the chief judge, that political hack, was shaking in rage and anger and did exactly what the Eighth Amendment said he had no constitutional right to do. He dishonored the robes he wore. He disobeyed the oath he took. That's what, and the threat to democracy in our country are judges like him. He's the threat, not the guy who puts his feet on Pelosi's desk. Corrupt, fraudulent judges who violate flagrantly the Constitution like that hack. And he's the chief judge, gets to preside over all the grand jury proceedings in the District of Columbia. He showed that he is sort of what Biden is, his fraudulency. The second that judge is his fraudulency, the chief justice. What he did was outrageous. He overtly said, because he was horrified that the commoners put their feet up on the great royal Pelosi's desk, that he decided to punish him using bail. That's what the Eighth Amendment explicitly and expressly prohibits. And while at the same time, the exact same district court in the District of Columbia lets Kleinsmith, who committed massive institutional fraud of the worst kind since the 60s and 70s with MK Ultra and all those kind of COINTELPRO, and let him walk right out the door so that the whole cumulative effect of Spygate is zero time for anybody.
And just everybody should, you guys have seen the video, so you know, but Kleinfeld modified an email from the CIA to the FBI confirming that Carter Page was a source, source in the past. Kleinfeld removed that and said altered the email to say from he was not a source to he was a source to he was not a source, because when they're applying to the FISA courts to get the warrants, the suspicious behavior that they were using and invoking was Carter Page's interaction with Russian entities. And so by creating the fact or faking the fact that he was not a source for the CIA, it eliminates the otherwise rational justification for why he had any connections with Russians or any interactions.
The entire premise for the mass mass spying and lying on the president's campaign that's behind both Spygate and Russiagate was that lie, because Carter Page was their access point to spying on everyone else under the three hop rule, which basically allows you to get somebody within 6 degrees of separation. If you can spy on Page, you can spy on Page's friends, and then you can spy on the friends of Page's friends or the associates thereof. More details have been coming out of the from some of the limited declassification that occurred, that there was just, they knew massive exculpatory evidence that they hid. There was massive entrapment campaigns run on the government payroll to try to defame and destroy the Trump campaign and then the Trump administration. And most of the people involved have received promotions or received book deals, or received media deals, or received professorships. Peter Strzok's wife is now the director of compliance for the SEC, which might be a bridge to the next conversation. But it shows you they have shown the whole world we're fraudulent, we're frauds, we're fakes, we're phonies, and the courts will only prosecute and punish the political dissidents and heretics. They'll do so selectively, and they'll do so severely, while letting their own crooks and criminals walk.
And so just to make it clear to everybody, no Kleinsmith, no Carter Page, no Michael Flynn, no Mueller investigation. And just also bear in mind, I would not draw the analogy to the guy who put his feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk. I would draw the analogy to Roger Stone, who, what were they asking in that sentencing memorandum for Roger Stone?
They originally asked for 8 years in federal prison for him misremembering certain facts that were completely immaterial to the investigation. Nobody.
I'll go one step further. I'll take for granted Roger Stone lied to them about his connections to WikiLeaks. He lied outright to the FBI in the investigation. They wanted to put this guy who was 70, he's an old man, in jail for 9 years for lying to the FBI in the context of their investigation. And Kleinsmith, who is a young whippersnapper on the right side of the political team, who materially falsifies a document to submit to a secret court to obtain a warrant to spy on an individual, effectively destroy Carter Page's life, by extension, destroy Michael Flynn's life, undermine a presidency, walks. Now, and they were only asking for 6 months. And I wasn't trying to be sympathetic. I'm just saying they're not. I don't even think they're going to get 6 months. And they zero probation. And he's still a member in good standing, according to the Bar Society online records, according to some articles. Wait, what can you do about it? At the very least, now everybody knows. And Robert, I mean, what can anybody do about it? What can you do about it? It is, everything you say is true. Rotten to the core. What can people do about it?
I mean, it exposes the system at a fundamental level, and then the next step is real meaningful institutional political reform. But the first step to identifying the need for a solution is identifying the problem. And this has unmasked the corruption of our judiciary, the corruption of the FBI, the corruption of major prosecutors in the Department of Justice at an institutional level to the degree that almost no one can ignore it. It's so obvious. It's right in people's face. That's why D.C. is so terrified of its own citizenry right now. They're putting up walls and gates and bringing in the military. And we have something that looks like the Green Zone from Baghdad in our national capital, because they frankly know that they're frauds and that's who they are. And so it's exposed it at a deep level. That's the good side of it. The bad side of it is that it even exists in the first place. But the contrast is just in the same week, you have this degree of selectivity. And you look at Ricky Vaughn, they're potentially looking for a 10-year federal prison sentence meme. But the guy who institutionally corrupted the entire law enforcement apparatus, who was at the key component to it, who they caught red-handed, is the guy who gets to write letters from home.
Hi. All right. What do we move into from here? Let me just see if I took a picture of a chat. We did. Oh, well, do you want to go into the GameStop or do we have anything else that's more appropriate of an intermediary segue?
No, I mean, I think that's a good bridge to GameStop because you see how the corruption works. Peter Stroke's wife. I mean, here's Peter Stroke, who was neck deep in this, who Durham's invested the sweetheart deal he cut for Kleinsmith, allowed Peter Stroke to walk free. He's got a professorship at Georgetown. He's got media contracts. He's got book contracts. He was the guy who helped coordinate all of this criminality, had to have known about it from the inception. They protected him by giving Kleinsmith the sweetheart deal. And now his wife gets promoted to the director of compliance at the SEC.
It is enough to make you puke in your mouth, swallow it, and then puke it back up. It's beyond anything. It is as though, I won't even say incompetence anymore, but government incompetence and government corruption gets rewarded. And we're sitting here, the lowly schnooks, having a Montreal Habs jersey thrown at us by the government for all our troubles, while they are, I would venture that position pays a couple hundred thousand dollars a year and they'll never miss a paycheck during a lockdown.
Exactly. Now, getting back to what can people do about it, some folks on the subreddit Wall Street Bets decided there was something they could do about it.
Robert gets the segues. I missed that one. That was a wide open home run. Good segue.
It was fantastical. So some of the background for all of what happened with GameStop is to understand two other things: what happened in 2008, and what the real nature of Wall Street and short selling as a subconstituent component of that is. In particular, one of the people that was caught up in this was a man by the name of Stephen Cohen. He's the show Billions hedge fund guy is inspired by the real life of Stephen Cohen. Some years ago, I helped screw him out of being able to buy the Dodgers just for the fun of it, just for the spite of it. Because I hate the guy. But to go back first, I think for 2008, because one of my favorite phrases is never forgive, never forget. And in this context, hold the line. So in the context of what happened here is that a subreddit formed and identified, and they were sort of dissident day trader types. And a lot of them were informed by what happened in 2008. A lot of them were sharing their stories in this context. And they're heartbreaking, heart-rendering stories. And for people who don't know, because conservatives were fed a big myth about what happened in 2008, the way a lot of people, like one guy just described it, the reason why he has never forgot and never forgiven is because he sees it in his everyday life today. He sees his father, who is a highly successful businessman, get so wrecked by what happened thanks to Wall Street and the big banks in 2008 that he's now a shell of himself and a daily alcoholic. He sees it in his brother. They all have life stories like this. Steve Bannon has a story like this. Part of what radicalized him was what happened in 2008. And there was never a real reconciliation of what took place there because the big boys got to walk. The big boys got bailed out while little people lost their homes, their businesses, and their livelihoods. And one of the myths that built up about this, and it fits two different myths because one of the myths is your Benji Shapiro myth about how Wall Street works. And just like the myth about how our government works, how the FBI works, how the CIA works, how Congress works, that have been unmasked during the Trump era in large part. Some of these were unmasked before. And the myth of Wall Street, as Benji Shapiro would put it, was Wall Street gets together and they just try to allocate capital to make sure it's the most efficient and productive. And by the way, my wife is a doctor. That is never been the case.
You're going to get hate for being mean to Ben Shapiro.
But he deserves it. The reason why I attack some of these people personally is they're not trustworthy sources. They don't give intelligent information. They don't give intelligent insight. They frequently give disinformation and misinformation. And just because he's on the conservative side of the culture wars and can take down some wokester nitwit kid in college doesn't make him a reliable, trustworthy source beyond that. And so he was actually pushing this during the middle of the GameStop stuff. That has never been the case with Wall Street. Wall Street is about greedy thieves looking for ways to steal from you and me. There have always been, as will be applicable particularly here, reverse Robin Hoods. They want to steal from the poor, get rich by stealing from the poor. And one of the ways so what happened during like the 2008 housing crash, the mythology was that the bank regulators came in and forced these poor banks to lend money that they didn't want to do, but they had to. And that's why the system failed. Well, there's two problems with it. One, I lived through it. As a young lawyer in 2001 and 2002, I was already suing banks all across the country for the subprime lending problem before anyone knew it was a big problem. And we couldn't get any attention from me and the guy who founded the public interest law firm, couldn't get any interest from either side of the political aisle because they were being enriched by their donations from the big banks, but also because it gave the illusion of prosperity to ordinary people. It's not a coincidence that we had the housing bubble at the same time China entered the WTO. So while people are actually getting stripped of their real equity in the economy, they're given the illusion that the things are great because of the housing bubble. It effectively distracted what was really happening in their economic lives. So it served a big political interest. That's number one. Number two, anytime you hear somebody tell you that the banks were forced by the mean regulators into doing something they didn't want to do, red flags should sprout up right away. There's no such thing. If a regulation came in, it's because the banks wanted that regulation. In this particular context, one of their potential restrictions on what they were doing, not only that, you should ask yourself, did the Clinton administration that helped deregulate banks and the Bush administration that was always in the pocket of banks really have mean regulations on the banks? Think that through. That never made any sense. But the banks did a good job of feeding that nonsense story to a lot of your conservative types, who many of them still believe it. Had nothing to do with it because I witnessed what happened. What happened was banks created a bubble to get rich off of ordinary people. And then when it crashed, they blamed ordinary people and pocketed the cash and got bailed out. And there's a lot of people still enraged about what happened because they never forget, never forgive. And when the time comes, hold the line. So what happened is some folks on the subreddit figured out the problem of short selling and how to financially aggregate their collective power to punish the short sellers. So what really happens in short selling, there's a great podcast by Eric Hunley, Unstructured Podcast, that he did yesterday with two people that are in this trade who will give you a very good background description of what took place. I am not a Wall Street approved financial advisor. Indeed, I'm not approved by Wall Street for much of anything. and I prefer to stay that way. And I hate banks. I'll sue banks just to sue banks. They're greedy people that just steal and rob. They don't make money. They're parasites. They're rarely productive. Apologies to any bankers in the audience. There's a few exceptions, I'm sure.
You're getting a surprising amount of love in the comment section for your impersonation of
people who've experienced that. They understand it. You know, I'm the lawyer I am because of how the system treated my father. And I am one of those people that will never forgive and never forget because the system decided to crush a little guy because they could. And they say the sins of the father are visited upon the son. Old scriptural reference. I like the opposite of that. The sins against the father are long remembered by the son. And there's a lot of people who are in that boat. The way Wall Street really operates is they look for opportunities to rob and steal. So in the 80s, when a guy like Stephen Cohen was an up-and-coming trader, the character from Billions is based upon or inspired by, the inside information was the name of the game. And often what you did was you went into a business like the movie Wall Street portrays, our second cinematic reference, where your real game, like you have Charlie Sheen, who's this nice, naive character who believes in the system only to discover the system isn't what it says it is. System isn't about what they claim it to be about. The mask is just a mask and the emperor is truly naked. And the way short selling works is not about a fair allocation of capital. Not because they often believe a business is worth less than it is. And GameStop was one of the classic examples of this. So frequently what they do is they target a small cap, medium cap businesses that can't defend themselves. They come in and they buy a big short. And the way they do that is always interesting. I mean, theoretically, they're borrowing the stock. They sell the borrowed stock. And then they have to buy it back within a certain time frame to give it back to the person they borrowed from. Sometimes it appears that isn't always what's happening. Sometimes it appears that they're naked selling. They're selling a stock that they haven't even borrowed in the first place. That's quasi illegal, but there's a whole bunch of exemptions and exceptions if you dig in. But basically what they do is they want to destroy a business. And the way they can destroy that business is by shorting the stock in enough volume and then creating, using their allies in the SEC, using their allies in government, using their allies in the press, in the financial press particularly, to often help destroy a business that's actually a good business. And like here in GameStop, you had a brick and mortar business that a lot of people, a lot of these kids, a lot of these young day traders grew up as gamers. So they grew up like my son did. He loved GameStop. I remember in LA, one of the first places he wanted to go, I thought, it's always a great place you could go. Where do you want to go? It's like, you got to take me to GameStop. And I was like, okay, I had never heard of GameStop. I mean, that was like the ultimate thing. Take him to GameStop. If you'd taken the little one to GameStop, maybe you'd remember that instead of saying, I don't remember daddy taking me anywhere, mommy. He kept me in the house all day after a day tours and travels of the little one. But they have a love affair in part with GameStop. They have good memories of GameStop. Well, Michael Burry, of the Big Short, who he did a short, but he was shorting the big banks. He wasn't shorting some small little guy. Early on identified that GameStop was a good stock and it didn't make sense the level to which it was going down. I mean, there was a point where it had more cash on hand than it was purportedly worth, which just didn't make sense. And so he decided to start buying it. People on the subreddit started pointing out there's a lot of good stocks that the only reason they're low valued is because these big hedge funds are trying to destroy them because they bought a big short position. And to make that short position come true, they need to destroy the business. And so these guys got together and said, well, what happens if we create our own fund equal to the or even bigger than some of these hedge funds? So you take, like, let's say you have 6 million or so, 5 million or so on the Wall Street Bets subreddit, which has a great little meme guy on the front of it. And they have average, say, $5,000 that they can trade with. Well, you start aggregating the math and they're bigger if they use their collective power than even some of the biggest hedge funds are, than even Cohen's hedge fund is. And so they figured out, hey, you know what? One, GameStop is a good stock. It's probably worth 10 to 20 times more than what's currently being traded for. Second, these guys have huge shorts. They had shorted more than the available stock. It was up to 140% of the stock had been shorted.
That's the thing. So that's a disputed fact that I'm having with people that I discuss this with. Some people are saying, no, it was only 140% shorted after they tried to cover their shorts, which I didn't really understand that rationale. But I don't even understand. How do you short more of a stock than exists?
That's a good question. I've heard a lot of people explain it and say that, you know, some people said, look, it's just the way the transaction is done that can happen without naked short selling occurring. There's other people that strongly suspect naked short selling. This was a big concern of Patrick Byrne back when he was at Overstock. And people like Elon Musk have been the victim of it. Patrick Byrne used to point out that there was that you could find institutionally a large, like what happened if people found out there's a bunch of stock that's been sold that the person didn't even ever own. He didn't even borrow it to own it. Think what that impact would be on the stock market. So that's why there are these collateral issues that could be implicated by what the hedge funds are doing. And so, and particularly because they make so much money shorting stock, mostly by destroying good businesses frequently. That's often what they're doing. So Elon Musk has been the repeated victim of short sellers. So he hates them with an unbridled passion. And so what happens is these guys get together and they're like, let's exercise our collective power. And it wasn't because they thought GameStop was necessarily worth $400. It was, you know what? We can wage war on the shorts and keep forcing them to buy at higher and higher rates. We can finally redistribute wealth from these Wall Street thieves who've been robbing from poor and working people for decades. And we can rob from them and make them give it right back to us because we can continue to short their short position by buying and holding the line.
And so,
as long as we bring our numbers, we show what populism looks like in a real free enterprise system. This is what it looks like. The best populist revolt against Wall Street functionally, maybe in its history. And all of a sudden, and what these arrogant, greedy hedge funds did, they even put out sarcastic comments about the Redditors, was often they doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down. They kept buying more shorts. And the market and the stock just kept going up, because these guys joined together, because for many of them, it was just a moral principle. It was like, I don't care if I lose my $5,000-$10,000 in the market. These SOBs are finally going to pay. They're finally going to hear me rage. They're going to get some sense of payback for what they've been doing and what they did. And the fact, when I found Stephen Cohen was connected to some of this, that Melvin Capital, one of the companies that had a big short position, is connected to Stephen Cohen, that he was trying to help bail them out. Stephen Cohen, his connected people were part of the biggest insider trading scandal in known public history. And yet he managed to never serve a day in prison because Preet Bharara is a coward at heart. I was even more thrilled. And if people want to see what a genius Stephen Cohen is, he tried to go at Dave Portnoy. I think it's Portnoy.
Yeah.
Who does Barstool Sports, who went after all these guys. And Stephen Cohen was so agitated that anybody would dare challenge him, one of the most corrupt actors on Wall Street and forever, makes Gordon Gekko look like a high beacon of ethics. He went after Portnoy, and Portnoy just kept coming back right at him, saying, no, you belong in prison, pal. You belong in jail, pal. And it was so effective to Stephen Cohen that he went off of Twitter. And this guy's supposed to be such a genius. That's how he made all those profits all these years, as Benji Shapiro would say, because of merit? I don't think so. He's a crook. He belongs in prison for life. But he got to walk because of how corrupt our system is. So at the peak of this, first you had a bunch of politicians calling for investigation of the Redditors, calling for the SEC to look into them, including that fake, that phony, that fraud. Senator from Elizabeth Warren, who always wanted to take on Wall Street. First thing she does, attack the Redditors on behalf of Wall Street.
And not just that, she comes in purporting that she's acting for the employees of GameStop, as if any of this has any direct impact on the employees of GameStop. But
save the employees. If the shorts had had their way, those employees would have all lost jobs and the business would be gone and dead. And they would have feasted, and the hedge funds would have feasted on the carcass. That's what they do. That's who they are. But she had to pretend to be doing that, because how do you keep the mask that you're really a critic of Wall Street when you're coming to bail them out at the greatest populist revolt against Wall Street in its history with real functional financial capital? People figured out if they put all their money together, you take all the day traders out there, they can be bigger than every single hedge fund. And if they collectively target their resources, they can defeat the hedge funds in critical areas of economic life.
And so everybody appreciates this. These are things that people who pay attention to know. There's a way of finding out. I mean, it's public information what percentage or what amount of a stock is currently being shorted. And so when you talk about this thing called the short squeeze, which is they had a short squeeze on steroids, is people are buying up the stock, which is driving the price up, which means that everybody who sold it and now has to buy it back to give back to the lender is basically seeing that they have to buy it back for more than they sold it for. And so they start buying it up in order to minimize their losses. But in so buying it up, it actually increase the price and exacerbate their own losses. And that's what you saw with GameStop, because people knew that there was an outrageous amount of shorts on that stock and they decided to exploit it. But here's the question. Sticking it to the hedge funds is fine. And you had that one hedge fund, I don't know what the name was, lost $5 billion. Some of these hedge funds maybe lost 70% of their value. This is the argument that I'm trying to understand. Are you sticking it to the hedge funds by eviscerating the hedge funds, or are you just punishing the investors on behalf of whom those hedge funds were investing money? Because so the hedge fund's going to lose its assets, but its assets are monies that it's in theory managing for individual investors. Am I wrong on that, or am I misunderstanding that?
No, but the hedge funds don't manage 401ks. Hedge funds manage money for other millionaires and billionaires predominantly. So I have no sympathy. And the hedge funds have been a nefarious institution, in my view, in Wall Street for a long time, along with all these big boys who don't take a productive focus on helping the ordinary person in the economy. They've been one of the greatest threats and damage to the economy and our politics. And what's really happening is, and to the extent that some of those hedge fund people are losing money, it's people on the high end of the scale losing money to people on the low and medium end of the scale. Now, some other people entered into this, Elon Musk, some other people were joining in. They're saying, get shorty, and that kind of stuff. So they helped facilitate it and promote it. But the main effect was to protect a small business from being destroyed by the shorts. The second part was getting revenge on these big hedge funds that steal and rob as a routine basis. And the third was redistribution of power and influence and money from people with a lot more of it to people with a lot less of it, which enters into the second stage. So while these real live subredditors of Wall Street bets were playing Robin Hood for real for the first time since Robin Hood, one of their means and tools was an app called Robin Hood. Now, this app purportedly was about helping the ordinary person get access to Wall Street.
Let the people trade was their motto.
Exactly. And that was their marketing pitch. Now, the reality behind Robin Hood was twofold. One, they were actually trading. They were using the information, like as you mentioned in the film Social Dilemma, if you're not paying anything for the product, you are the product and you're paying that way. And so what the big funds were using the information from this aggregate collective of Robinhood, and that was the real client of Robinhood. The customer was purportedly the client, but they weren't. The real client was the people using that information, often hedge funds, to front run, in some cases, their bets, and using that information, a kind of inside information, but not denominated so legally, to run ahead of the curve and monetize. Well, now the second part was the Wall Street had been using apps like Robinhood to get people to inflate the value of the stock market by using their stimulus checks and their lockdown lives to become day traders. And the thought process was, we can get all of this cash that theoretically the government's giving to ordinary people to really come back to us, Wall Street. Not satisfied with the government put, not satisfied with the Fed put. They needed a stimmy put to on top of it. And so they never thought it could be used against them. They didn't recognize what happens when you give the peasants too many pitchforks. You think they're harvesting for you. Maybe they're going to use it against you.
And just so everybody appreciates this, and if anybody hasn't seen it, watch Eric Hunley's live stream yesterday with two experts. I forget their names.
W-A-N-G, but pronunciated W-A-N-G. Andy and I think Chris.
And it's amazing. It's fascinating. I say their only curse is that they're two experts to be able to simplify it enough. But the one thing about, they were saying all of these free trading apps, it's a known thing in the industry. Yeah, they're selling your data to hedge funds and to other investment entities so they can, get a feel for the market and, see what the tastes are and what people are doing. But it's one, and I was listening in the car and I was on data, so I couldn't get involved. It's one level more nefarious than that people don't really appreciate. It is transmitting the data, actually, from what I understand and from what I've read. It was transmitting this data, selling this data to hedge funds before the trade would go through. And so these hedge funds are getting, not just in real time, but ahead of your actual action, data that allows them to, in turn, make decisions almost before the person playing has a chance to have their order go through. So their order is not just being collected for data and sold. It's being sold in a manner that's going to negatively affect them and or potentially negatively affect them, which is
It was the tool by which they were taking them on. And so they just never thought this tool could be used against them. And so what do? Robinhood suddenly shuts down the app. You can sell, but you can't buy. And at a perfect key time to drop the stock enough so that these big shorts, these big hedge funds could get out of their tough short position. Still lose a lot of money, but lose nowhere near what they were doing because Musk and the rest were trying to drive this up to 1,000. They were going to start wiping out hedge fund after hedge fund after hedge fund. These, particularly the greediest, most pernicious, nastiest ones. Because, I mean, be frank, a good, honest hedge fund wouldn't be massively shorting GameStop. Any hedge fund that's shorting is a hedge fund that needs to be cleaned out, and a true free market would be with these aggregate actors. So they couldn't allow the free market to do. So we got to see how big tech doesn't plan on just controlling speech, doesn't just plan on manipulating elections, doesn't just plan on culturally compelling certain thoughts. It's now being used to prevent you from being able to even trade using an app called Robinhood, whose marketing pitch was free the people to trade. So it shows the scale and scope of the corruption. Now, they got such blowback that they didn't anticipate. You had Portnoy going around everywhere saying, these people belong in prison, those people belong in prison. They didn't expect this, a scale of it. Such that, you know, Tucker Carlson is putting it on there. Other people, you saw a populist alignment across the left and the right. Now, if you're as dumb and as fraudulent as AOC, you blow that up single-handedly, but putting her aside, in the real populist left and right, there was a huge alignment from the Jimmy Dores to the Alex Joneses. They were all gung-ho on let's wage war on Wall Street, using our little bit of little apps and our little bit of cash to do so. And so they end up coming back on it. But of course, the question was, how could Robinhood do this, given they promised people contractually and in their marketing that the whole point was to let people trade. And that led to a class action suit against them.
Now I should present the position from what was explained by people who are smarter than me on this subject. Robinhood's explanation might have been very lacking. It might have been disingenuous. It might have been a total lie. Apparently, some people are hypothesizing that Robinhood's motivation was actually that they were being blocked. What was it? What was the issue? That when you facilitate these trades, because there's a 2-day clearing period or 1 to 2 day clearing period, sometimes the trading app or I forget who it is required to put up a percentage of the sale between 1% and 3%. And because the volume was so high on GameStop, Robinhood couldn't put up this couldn't front the advance that they would have to front on these trades, which is why they were compelled to stop trading on the stock.
That explanation. I've heard some other ones that the SEC forced them to do so. There's some suspicions on that accord because our new Treasury Secretary took a lot of money for speeches to Wall Street over the last several years, including I think it's over 800 grand from one of the big hedge funds that was neck deep in problems related to GameStop. And so when the press secretary was asked about this, the press secretary said, don't worry, she's a woman. There's a woman. So yes. Now all of a sudden, yes, you get to see what identity politics is really about. It's about it's a convenient mask to allow the same game of corruption and fraud to occur, but say magically it can't occur because of their race, gender, identity, or gender. The problem for the Biden administration is everybody left and right can see it in live time. And they're like, that's not an explanation. Not only that, apparently she signed an ethics agreement that she wouldn't be involved in anything concerning anybody she'd received fat checks from in the last year, but apparently has refused to exercise that obligation. So it is possible. And then, of course, the head of the SEC, currently for director of compliance, is none less than Peter Strzok's wife. So you still have that, with the infamous Peter Strzok of Spygate, Russiagate, corruption and collusion. So that's possible, but a lot of people, both Zero Hedge, the Wall Street Bets guy, Portney, and other people were deeply skeptical because of the timing of this. And Zero Hedge, for people who don't know, they know it from sort of dissident outsider politics. It started as a lot of dissident Wall Street guys from in the mid 2000s, 2004, 2005, 2006, Nobody still knows who they are. But they were, they're very knowledgeable in this field, and they were just pointing out fact after fact that said Robin Hood's story doesn't make sense. Now the official legal excuse, all the you know, law professors quickly stepped in to explain you can't sue Robin Hood. Of course not. Cause all these guys are in the bag for these boys. And they said the reason you can't is because there's an exculpatory clause in Robin Hood's contract that says they can stop you from trading at any time for any reason. The problem with that is unless you have a judge as corrupt as the judge in the Amazon case in Western District of Washington, that makes the whole rest of the contract and all of their marketing inconsequential. So if that was the whole contract, okay, but it's not the whole contract.
Well, no, and not just that. It's let me just take this chat off. It's not just a question of stopping the trading. It was a question of only allowing the sales, which is effectively, I want to call it market manipulation for lack of a better word, but that's forcing the shorting of the stock because all people can do is sell. It for anybody who doesn't know, it triggers people's stop losses, people who've set automatic sell orders, and it creates a tank, which it in fact did. It created such a tank. I think it went down like 50% from whatever 100 to 130 and then back up. But you imagine what that difference in the tank allowed the hedge funds to buy back or to get out of their short positions at. The differential was exponential.
Especially everybody got to see collusion in live time. Because, I mean, this is how the reason why I connected the short selling to Wall Street is because it's just a different version of insider trading, capitalizing on relationships in illicit ways with the media and the government to actually get rich at the expense of ordinary people, not to have maximum productivity, whatever nonsense Benji Shapiro is talking about. That's the way it really works. It always reminds me of another great movie, Back to School. And Ben Shapiro's position reminds me of Dean Thornton. Who's saying it, Rodney Dangerfield's going back to school. He's actually been a real businessman in the movie. That's his character. And Dean Thornton says, we're going to build projects. We're going to make widgets. And here's a whole business plan. He lays out all this business plan. And Rodney Shapiro's pointing out, Roger Dangerfield is pointing out, Rodney Dangerfield, Lord have mercy. Rodney Dangerfield's pointing out one. He goes, you need to bribe these people. You need to take care of those people. You need to worry about the unions. You need to worry about who actually controls some of those unions, so on and so forth. And Dean Thornton says, oh, that's not who we are. Well, we're an ethical business and so forth. And that's just, and he wanted to believe in the mythical fictional version of Wall Street that economics professors teach students all across the country every day, the mythology of it that's meant to excuse its wealth making, which is mostly just thieving and stealing. And so at a later point, the professor says, well, where should we place this factory of ours to start the business? And Rodney Dangerfield says, how about Disneyland? Because it's as much of a fantasy as that place is. And so that's the Benji Shapiro version of these events. What's happening is tons of people are seeing in live time the whole system unmasked because the insider collusion that allows for insider trading also is the insider collusion that allows for the short selling to be profitable. And the businesses have to be complicit in the process. Just research how Stephen Cohen got to walk despite massive evidence of massive corruption. I detailed that to people that helped prevent him from buying the LA Dodgers years ago. And now he owns the New York Mets. I don't care about the Mets, so that's their problem. Seeing him taken down a few notches is just, it's worthy of a cigar. I might have to light it one of these days. But the net effect is people get to see in live time, either Robin Hood's doing this at the behest and the behalf of the government, or they're doing it at the behest and the behalf of their real clients or customers because their real explanation isn't holding water. And that led to the class action that I think will get past the dismissal stage because there's facts. And I think there's going to be a lot more class actions. I've been recommending to people bring class actions within each state under each state's laws. So you diversify the courts you have access to. Don't depend on just the Southern District of New York or federal court. There's a lot of places you can sue as far as I can tell, because in my view, the biggest lie here wasn't the contractual breach. It was the marketing lie. They got a lot of people to buy Robinhood by promising them they could trade and then suddenly and summarily revoked that when it served their real interest in collusion and market manipulation on Wall Street.
And I mean, that is my question. And now that we've appreciated these incestuous ties between the SEC and the powers that be, as far as I'm concerned, the overt market manipulation is not a bunch of people on Reddit, and we're talking legit freedom of speech, protected speech, saying, go buy the stock, here's why, here are the metrics, and do it. It's Robinhood saying sell only now for everyone who has this stock, tanking the price deliberately, because now we know behind the vaccines, they are beholden not to the people, you know, who they're giving a free app to, but to the people buying that data who are now saying, kill it literally because we're dying here, and they do it. Now, the chances of some sort of SEC investigation into Robinhood, I mean, from what I'm reading on you, Robert, slim to none.
They may try to, because that's their usual protocol. What helps the insider traders and the short sellers is the complicity of the SEC. That's why I recommend people watch the show Billions. Like some people are, you know, don't watch it to get attached to characters or anything else. Watch it because it's an expose of how Wall Street really works and how the so-called criminal prosecutors really work. Where these the rotating door at the SEC, where do those people end up after they work at the SEC? Where do some of their friends and family end up working at the SEC? They protect the big boys to come after the little people. But can they realistically come after 10 million Americans? Good luck with that. So that's why it's not going to go anywhere. Plus the or it's not likely to go anywhere. They would like it to. But the blowback politically, it's another example where they just weren't ready. They don't understand the country. They don't understand there's never been a resolution of what happened in 2008. The real culprits were never held responsible, were never held liable because of the complicity and corruption, particularly of prosecutors in New York, but also elsewhere in that part of the process. And that's why, yeah, and again, credit to the Texas Attorney General steps into the as the only real populist advocate out there consistently. He's demanding all the information about all of these colluding operators on Wall Street in protection of the people on the subreddit. So they thought they could crush the subreddit. Instead, they held the line. And instead, it's a lot of big billionaires and hedge funds that are going to take the hit. And I think politically, ultimately, the blowback is going to go in that direction because the ordinary person is seeing it. The ordinary politician is seeing it. And they're realizing, oh, we really can't go where we thought we could go. We can't play the rules, play the game we're used to playing. Because a lot of these senators, for example, Millionaires Club, have insider dealing that goes on a routine basis. And they realize that, you know, at some point when the peasants have more pitchforks, there's not much they can do other than be on the peasant side at some level. So I think it's an extraordinary, one of the most incredible things to ever witness. It shows the power of the people to come up with solutions despite problems that seem incurable, despite problems that seem insurmountable. Just a few kids on subreddit showed that you can, in fact, change the world.
And now before I ask this next question, it is my time to do the weekly reminder. We're at 13,776 people and I think 3,600 thumbs up. Let's break the system one more time. Thumbs up. And everyone put in a comedic joke in the chat and see what happens when 13,000 people flood YouTube with a chat. But not before I get to the super chat.
That's what all this was about. That's what it was about, the power of the people combined. This was one of the most great populist revolutionary acts I've ever witnessed. It aligned the populist left and right, the authentic ones, within minutes while exposing all the frauds and the fakes and the phonies within seconds. How many congressmen said nothing? How many senators said nothing? How much of the Biden administration had to hide? How much did the press? What was the press's attack? These must be alt-right neo-Nazis who are getting together, connected to Trump somehow. I mean, the ludicrous lies. They have their old script, and they just change a few names, and they think that works, not realizing they're exposing themselves to a whole new audience who's like, oh, you guys have been lying all along. Newsweek, you're frauds. Axios, you're frauds. All of you are frauds. It was beautiful to witness.
This came up early in the pandemic when we found out that a few politicians were selling their stocks in advance of publicly disclosing the upcoming doom. I've heard people say, and I think we mentioned it a couple times, insider trading is not illegal for politicians.
Not here in Washington.
Well, formally not illegal, or there's just no such thing as insider trading? Like,
formally not illegal. So, now, there's the good explanation for it was, here's my view. My view is you get elected to Congress, you can't trade in the stock market, period. Because their practicality was, we get so much information. If anything we get information as a House or Senate member is now called inside information, it will be difficult for us to ever trade without being easily accused. And my answer was, I recognize that problem. Solution, if you decide to get elected to the House or Senate, you give up the right to own any stocks.
How does
put them in a truly blind trust? Not one of those Venetian blind trusts that you can take a peek whenever you need to, but a truly blind trust if you're going to go that route. It's routine. It's open. As another example of hypocrisy, when Richard Burr was caught doing so, they just shut down that whole investigation this week too. If you have power and privilege in Washington, you get to walk free if you're on the right side of the political aisle.
Okay, but now because I still don't think I understand. It is not formally the idea is that it's not formally illegal. It's still technically illegal, just that nobody
It's all legal. It's all legal. If the basis of your inside information is what you learned in Congress, it could still be a crime if you get inside information outside of your congressional duties. The theory was, it's unfair to do that to Congress members because of how it could complicate their ability to do their jobs as Congress members. Blah, blah, blah.
Well,
it was licensing bribery so that they serve the interest of Wall Street.
It would seem to me that would be the sacrifice that people would make when they want to get a guaranteed $170 or whatever $1,000 a year plus benefits plus everything. Because if a lawyer, in the context of his or her employment, learns some information about a client's business, even though it's in the same context of doing business, they'll get disbarred and they will get imprisoned for trading on that information.
Unless they're on the right political side, because I've dealt with some lawyers on the opposite side that have done precisely that. Right politics, it's immunity.
Because I'm literally flabbergasted. I always thought it was sort of a tongue in cheek. Yeah, they're immune because nobody prosecutes. I didn't realize that there was a discussion had and they decided.
It used to be illegal. Now it's not.
Well, I want to puke.
Well, this might be a good bridge. It transitions into my Supreme Court cert petition being filed tomorrow on behalf of the Covington boys, challenging Elizabeth Warren and Deborah Haaland. Deborah Haaland is now being promoted to the Secretary of Interior, now going to be a cabinet official position. And here both of them lied and libeled these kids. And they said that election to Congress was a license to libel. And part of the issue raised, I'm saying, one, the Westfall Act was never meant to expand congressional immunity beyond the speech and immunities clause. Second, even if it was, it doesn't apply to statements like this that are gratuitously voluntarily made on a social media to lead a lynch mob against a bunch of private citizen minor children over an event that had no connection to pending legislation and was people they did not represent, and they were not responding to press or public inquiry regarding it. And then third, the other big problem with this, aside from there's federal circuit decisions that don't go this far, state Supreme Courts that disagree with this in analogous context of legislative immunity, and whether the speech and immunities clause was supposed to be a ceiling, not a floor on the limits, is the practical issue of this related to this, which is if Congress can pass a law that allows them to get away with torts against private citizens with no consequence whatsoever, literally election of Congress being a license to lie and libel, even private citizens that have nothing to do with pending legislation, well, maybe why can't they just pass a law immunizing themselves from all crime? They can now commit murder. No consequence. They can now commit rape, sexual assault. No consequence. They can do anything. They can steal. They can bribe. They can do anything else. And by the way, congressmen in the past have tried to argue the speech and immunities clause allowed them to do bribery as long as the bribery took place on the floor. So we know they're capable of this. And now we see with the insider trading and how it corrupts Congress and not wanting to meaningfully investigate what Robin Hood did and whether they did so on behalf of institutional banks or whether they're maybe even complicit in causing Robin Hood to do because they're more interested in protecting hedge fund people than ordinary Americans. Maybe they'll immunize themselves from more things. So it goes to the core of not only this little case has a much bigger ramification that's beyond libel. It's does Congress have the power to immunize themselves from anything they want, anytime they want, any place they want? Or is there a constitutional constraint on such power? And this case will answer that question if we can get the Supreme Court to take it. The petition is filed tomorrow morning.
Okay, now I will do a dedicated segment specifically on the filed version. So when that's filed, you're going to send it to me. I'm going to cover it and do an update from the last one I did. It will be an amazing thing to follow, and fingers crossed, because these are not just good questions. These are fundamentally important questions for anyone to I won't say maintain faith in the system, because I think everybody watching here probably doesn't have much, but to restore faith in the system.
Exactly. And my view is, if we don't get the Supreme Court to take it, I'm going to use it. And some congressmen like Thomas Massey, his staff has already expressed interest, making this a political issue and a legislative issue. So make 2022, make everybody, my view is to pass a broad law that says that there is no that for members of Congress, there is no immunity from any tort. There's no immunity from any crime solely because you did it in the name of your legislative duty, unless it fits within the speech and immunities clause. And that means, and the same with insider trading, all of it. Let's make it so election to Congress is not a license to libel. Election to Congress is not a license to steal. Election to Congress is not a license to do harm. And make it a broad, and make everybody answer during the campaign in 2022 whether they will support that law. So because if you're a member of Congress, years ago, the D.C. Circuit pointed this out. They said if Congress wants to expand beyond the speech and immunities clause, there's constitutional questions whether they even can. But if they do, let them answer to the public. The way they got away with it is they passed a law that said nothing about this and then pretended after the fact, years later, that it magically immunized them, even though they never got the consensus of the public because they didn't even tell them that's what they were doing. Let's have it be open in front. If we can't get the Supreme Court to take the case, that means there's no judicial remedy. Force it is an issue every day in every congressional race in the country. Every House member, every senator, answer the question. And my view is to expand it to state legislatures and governors and other people where there may be some question in the future, that election to Congress is a duty and obligation to the public, not an opportunity to scam them, lie about them, and try to defame and destroy them.
And insider trade your way to
make people representative of the government, and you could incorporate potentially even more provisions on this. Not only limiting lobbying, but limiting just being able to make money. Period. After you leave Congress for anything connected to your prior duties, because and the regulatory machine. Because right now, what happens is these senators who are planning on retiring, they don't care about their constituents anymore at all. They only care about who's going to make me rich at the end of this, who's going to give me prestige at the end of this, who's going to give me status at the end of this. Will I get a media contract? Will I get a professorship? Will I get a sweet consulting contract? Will I get a sweet book deal? Will I get nice fat speech fees?
Well, I brought up Linda's chat here. How do you think politicians like Harry Reid leave office with so much money?
Nancy Pelosi make so much money? How did Dianne Feinstein make so much money? The only guy to lose a lot of money by being elected to public office was Donald Trump. That's the only guy that's lost money in forever in seeking office. For the last half century, you could get enriched way past your 170 grand plus benefits plus pension amount because of who would pay you off. The quid pro quo just came after you left office.
No crap. If I knew they were going to announce a global lockdown, I sure as heck would sell my hotel. I mean, I wouldn't, but I mean, you sell your hotel stocks, your Marriott and your Starwoods before the news. You don't even have to make money. Just don't lose as much as the lowly hoi polloi. And by the way, now full disclosure, by the way, I bought a small position in Nokia. So I didn't get into GameStop. I think Nokia might actually be an undervalued in the long run. So full disclosure, so that no one accuses me of hiding the fact, I have a very small position. So I could also be part of the story. Plus, you know, when I was doing my video on Friday, I was like, crap, why not? This is an amazing story to be a part of. So that's it. We'll see. But I never forgive off the stock market. So just that should be a warning to everybody.
and just never forgive, never forget, and hold the line.
Now, we're running close on time. Questions from locals. Robert, do you have them or do I have them?
Both of us probably do, but I know what some of them are.
Okay, go. You grab a couple.
I'll start with two different ones. One common one was about the president's defense on the impeachment trial, given that it appears his current existing legal counsel has left the case. I don't know who's going to be replacing them. I'm happy to help in whatever way, and he and his team are aware of that. But I haven't been retained at this point, so I can speak freely about it. What I had spoken to on the show, The Gaggle, which I like because as Peter Lavelle and George Samueli and Kiara,
it's a good show.
They, things from an outsider independent perspective. They live overseas. They always provide independent idiosyncratic information from an often populist perspective, but from an international recognition of someone not caught up within the U.S. media sphere. And as I explained on that show a couple of days ago, that basically the Lindsey Graham line of defense is not one that Trump has to do, that Lindsey Graham and the rest of them were bluffing. They don't have 66 or 67 votes. The question of 66 votes is whether or not Leahy can actually vote, since he's both the juror and the judge, apparently, in the case. I mean, this is getting preposterous, because Roberts wanted nothing to do with this because it was an obvious problem, S show, as they would say. And my argument was they don't have 67 votes. It's mutually assured destruction if they go down that path. There's not enough suicidal senators, politically suicidal senators, to do so. They already figured out I went back and looked from the polls from January 5th to January 19th in YouGov within key interior demographics, internal demographics, Trump's approval rating didn't budge at all. So that meant that all of the attempts to blame him for January 6th and to make January 6th this insurrection, as they tried to pretend it was, rather than just a chaotic riot with a wide range of groups doing things for a wide range of reasons, the most of which was nonviolent, only a small portion of it was violent, was not going to blow back on Trump. And it didn't. And they were shocked by that. So my argument was, for the president, you know, use whatever leverage you want. They don't have 67 votes. They don't got it. They don't have 17 Republican senators willing to walk the plank. And it likely would kill the Republican Party. And when I was out and about speaking to people, that was even more clear. The crowds and the audience they have no interest in seeing that happen within the Republican base or within a large part of Trump's independent base. And so McCarthy went down to talk to Trump, and I'll probably get into this in more detail with Richard Barris, the People's Pundit, on the political side. But from a legal side, he can use the impeachment trial to put the Senate on trial itself. Also get into what really happened on January 6th. Did Senator McConnell have certain information that he didn't disclose to his fellow senators? Did Speaker Pelosi have certain information she didn't disclose? Did the seventh floor at the FBI lie to the Capitol Police and withhold information that the FBI in New York and Virginia had given them? Why was the security so unusually low that day? Why was the response what it was? Why was some House members and senators apparently deceived into believing it was something that it was not? So there's a lot of questions there. There's also questions about the fact of Congress simply not performing its duty constitutionally. And it basically the way the president, why that's pertinent is they're saying him contesting the election was somehow criminal action. And aside from the fact it couldn't be constitutionally illicit incitement for the reasons we talked about before, it affords him the opportunity to put on trial. Here's why I believed what I did. And I can go through, here's all the times Congress has previously objected to elections. And here's why I believed I had a good faith basis to question the constitutionality of this election. And put some of that in the record, because they don't want it there. They did everything possible to bury it. And conveniently, the Capitol Hill riots were used as the pretext to help defeat that opportunity on the 6th and the 7th. So the early morning of the 7th. So there's a lot of things he could go into to expose a lot of people, and then expose on the other side. How can you call this insurrection or anything like it, given what happened all summer? That who's responsible for people thinking that this is an okay means of violence when it's not? Well, it's because the Democrats greenlight it all summer. Media greenlight it all summer.
If you're going to compare Trump's speech, which was scrubbed from the internet so nobody could hear him say, you know, peacefully march down and protest like you're allowed to by the Constitution, compare that to Maxine Waters telling people, you know, her supporters to get in the face and harass Republicans. I forget who the other woman was that talked about her soldiers on the ground. The other ones, you know, to continue riding in the streets, Kamala Harris. So you want to talk about if that type of speech is going to be put on impeachment trial, bring it all on. But the question is this. First question, who's going to see this? Is anybody going to air this? Is it going to get any?
C-SPAN, if it's in the House and the Senate. Here's the thing. If they're smart, I think, or the Senate in this context, the president just is starting to realize he has a lot more leverage than initially he was sort of thought in the last several weeks. And that's also a function of the fact he doesn't have the same people in the White House around him. So there are some good people in the White House that are still with him. There are some bad actors in the White House that are now not. And so I think he's developing better clarity of what power and leverage he has. They really gaslit him into thinking he did not have authority that he did. I think that's partially why the pardons went the route they did. And now he's witnessing it. When he saw that vote and saw they only have five senators to even say the Senate can have a trial, and then he sees the public opinion poll that says he starts a Patriot Party, he kills the Republican Party overnight everywhere because there's more people who will vote for the Patriot Party than vote for the Republican Party. He could effectively replace the Republican Party. I'll get into that tomorrow as to how much leverage that is and why that may not be the problematic aspect some Republicans think it is, in that it may replace the Republican Party overnight. But what, and then he saw the polls out of Wyoming that showed Liz Cheney is about to lose, has no, almost no chance at this point of winning re-election. And he realized, hold on a second, I have a lot more leverage here, and let's maybe use some more leverage. You want to go to a trial? Okay, I want discovery about what everybody knew. I want discovery about what the FBI knew, and I want to finally get my public hearing on the record on what happened in the election, because I was denied it at every single level, denied it by every single judge, denied it by the House, denied it by the Senate meaningfully. And do you want that on the record? Because most Americans still haven't really heard it. They've heard the caricatured version of it. And I guarantee you that they don't want that in the Senate. So, you know, maybe what the Senate does is they sit back and say, you know what? We'll just censor them so we don't get embarrassed and just end this whole charade so that this whole doesn't happen. So I think that's also why he's escalating in that regard. But I don't know who's going to represent him. And if you know Trump, you never know exactly what he's going to do.
All right, now I'm going to try one thing. Talk about crowdsourcing. Tweet out that Robert Barnes should represent Trump and see how far that goes, because that would be beautiful. But Robert, I mean, what do I make of him losing counsel? People are asking, and it was one of the questions I think in locals.
Those are all Lindsey Graham handpicked those people. So those were Lindsey Graham's people, and Lindsey Graham's pitch was, "Hey, if you just play nice, just say that you shouldn't be tried after you're no longer in office, and you keep your head low and bow to the Senate, then you won't get convicted and everything will be okay. Don't raise any issue. Don't question the Senate. Don't question their authority really beyond just saying, hey, you know, let's move on." And that's what all of those lawyers were doing. And they're frankly, I have reason to believe they were handpicked by Lindsey Graham, not the president. They were fed to the president as here's the best way for the Senate to defend you now.
Is it public? And I don't want to ask anything that you're not at liberty to discuss. Is it public as to whether or not they quit or they got fired or it was mutual because they had a different version or vision of the strategy to be adopted?
I think it's public knowledge that there was a difference of opinion. They publicly said that they weren't willing to raise any issue related to the election. And Trump said, well, I want counsel who's going to have at least that as an option. And so let's go our separate ways. And it was that. And so
okay, not to ask the ridiculous question, Giuliani's off the table. I think he's too far into things to be.
He wouldn't be the guy. I mean, Dershowitz has volunteered, so I think he should take Dershowitz as part of that defense. But obviously, Giuliani, Powell, and Wood are not the people. So he has a list of people that are understand the election issues and can incorporate it however he wants to in the defense. And I think there's a very clear, clean way to do that doesn't unnecessarily ruffle feathers, but defends himself appropriately and documents the record as it should be, because right now it's not well documented. It's not well demonstrated. And there's a lot of evidentiary issues that were unanswered, that he had every constitutional entitlement to have the constitutional process invoked in the same way even Nancy Pelosi did in 2017, in the same way some of his impeachment managers for the Democratic side did so in 2017. He just wants the rules to apply at least a little bit equally. And that would be the argument and the pitch and the presentation as part of it. I mean, there's all the other problems. I mean, it's a First Amendment violation. It's a violation of the impeachment clause. It's an unconstitutional bill of attainder. It's a violation of free speech. It's a violation of due process. It's all of those things in addition to it. But you might as well demonstrate that he had a good faith basis to raise questions about the election and also figure out why that the Capitol Hill riots are about the failure of Capitol Hill police. That appears to be the product of what the FBI misled them and apparently what Mitch McConnell didn't take protective action on. That, too, is part of the record.
Anybody wants an amazing analysis of that, go to Nate Brody's channel. I suspect everybody here already knows. Nate Brody did an amazing expose, breakdown, all public information. Just put it together, concise, so everybody can truly appreciate
what and the you know, a cop background. So his politics might be part commie, but he's a good cop, and he has yeah. he has a legal experience from that.
And what else?
We'll skip for now the Ghislaine Maxwell motion to dismiss. We'll see how that develops. Come back to it another time. We covered the bail. I'll give the Georgia State Bar credit. This was one of the questions that was asked on the Locals subscriber board. Viva, barneslaw.locals.com. And for those people that occasionally ask, why is there a charge and why do I recommend a template for other people to use? Part of the reason we're using Locals is to get other people to utilize it. Eric Hunley, Unstruck, now has is on Locals. Tulsi Gabbard is now on Locals. Richard Barris, People's Pundit, is now on Locals. Is because of look at what happened with Robinhood. Look at what happened before. You need apps that you know what you're paying for, not know what you're paying for. And Locals is independent. It's as independent as possibly can be. It doesn't monetize your personal information. It doesn't invade your privacy. And it's building a template where you can get independent content created as free as is practicable from the censors and suppressors and those with a conflict of information.
The thing that I think most people are going to like, people support on YouTube, and it's great. It's easy, and it's just at the tip of your fingers. YouTube takes 30% of content creators' revenue that they generate. Locals takes 10. So you're also supporting something that's a better entity.
And I get people that's a little bit clunky to use at times and all the rest, and they're not used to something that doesn't have algorithmic manipulation in it. So they're like, hey, why am I not getting this kind of feed? There's things that they're improving. They're getting live streams. They're getting other capacity capability. But I do a videos content on there. Viva puts up sneak peeks of his video content on there. I answer questions every single week of
It's worth it to see Robert. You've been doing these episodes of Hush Hush, which are phenomenal. You do movie reviews. It's fantastic. Imagine everyone watching this. It's Robert without this face on the side talking for like 7 to 14 minutes about an issue. It's phenomenal. It's worth
it. The utility of it's uncensored. So I can talk about a wide range of topics. I can talk about, you know, where this IW comes from on this cup. I can talk about a wide range of things that YouTube will take offense at, an umbrage at. So it's a good place to get uncensored inside information and insights about a wide range of subjects and topics. But to that, one of the questions was, I was curious how the Georgia State Bar would come at Lynn Wood, because to date, there, to my knowledge, no client complaint yet had been filed with any state bar. I have problems with what the Delaware court did, and there has been no court otherwise find him to do sanctionable activities within that court yet. There are sanctions motions pending in some cases, though it appears Sidney Powell's dismissed almost all those cases, so I'm not sure how active some of those claims are. But I'll give Georgia State Bar credit, but I think it's a precarious place for state bars to go, which is the almost a lot of the state bars, and sometimes it's the Supreme Court that governs lawyers, sometimes it's the state bar that's given that authority derivatively through the state Supreme Court, which always holds the ultimate authority, is that if someone has a serious mental illness, drug problem, alcohol problem, it's impairing their ability to be a functioning lawyer, they have authority to suspend or disbar the lawyer on that basis. It should be, I've always had problems with it. My view is if there's really a problem, it should be a violation of existing rules. If it's not, it's just a convenient pretext to get rid of people you don't like. And it's almost always going to be used against dissidents. And as anyone who's followed me knows, I'm not a fan of Lynn Wood. I've said that, you know, he needs a jacket where his arms don't move. And I've been unkind, frankly, in my comments because I thought he was doing some damage to important cases and causes. But I have problems with the state bar using this as a pretext to go after a political dissident without a viable existing client complaint. But apparently what Lynn Wood has done is so the state bar is coming after him and said, well, we won't suspend your license if you'll submit to a mental health exam to see what your status is. He refused to participate in that mental health exam. So it may mean they may be on an accelerated path to suspend or disbar him because of that. Now, he has been, again, he's behaving in ways that are not wise for any lawyer to behave in, and has been counterproductive in a wide range of cases. And that behavior has deteriorated rather than gotten better. But I still have major problems with this approach. I think it's a way to short circuit the ethical process. It's a misuse and abuse of licensing power. But I don't think that I think Linwood will constitutionally contest it at every level, but I don't have a great degree of confidence in his capacity to succeed in that context.
Robert, this might have been the formal. You guys are live, by the way. Just this is not after show discussion. So, let's see. Okay, so and there's an issue with the submitting to the mental examination because it's part of the ethics or the part of the obligations of an attorney. I guess you sign on to it when you become an attorney. So it's not like as invasive as it would be. Just I guess it is invasive. I find it the whole idea to be pretty outrageous. But for people who are saying it's sort of Daddy. Like the argument would be that it's what you sign on to and it's your obligation as an attorney if they make that call. But I think the call is I think it's it's an invasive call.
Agreed. One of the locals' questions they asked, a lot of them asked about the election audits that may be occurring in in multiple places, may occur in Michigan, currently under debate in Arizona, may occur in Georgia and Pennsylvania. Right now, there's no consequence for that beyond changing the law, using that to change the law. But it is possible if the president decides to incorporate it as part of his defense, that it could be part of the defense the president presents to document it and detail it on the record. So that's about all that can be done. I do hope they move forward with those audits, but I hope they move forward beyond just looking at the machines. I hope they look at whether the handwriting signatures matches was meaningfully done and correctly done. We already know from sample size that that wasn't done in Arizona. And so I would like them to do a broader audit of that. And that's where the debate currently is. What is part of that audit? Because that's the key to any audit is which books you look at.
I'm making sure the kid in the back is not touching the thermostat again
today. Yeah, he did that so clearly, just went right up and went, boop, doop, doop. Oh, he heard you say thermostat, and he's inspired by the idea. Let's see. Oh, the lawsuit we'll get into later as the case in another episode, the lawsuit against Twitter posting illicit conduct content. Yeah,
that's a touchier one. We'll see where that discussion happens. And there was another question that I was going to talk about. A Rittenhouse we can get. We'll do some updates in Rittenhouse next week, I guess.
There may be updates coming on that case.
Well, it was the
civil case was dismissed against him this week.
Sorry, but the civil case was dismissed, which Rakeda covered today. So no impact on the criminal case, but it's an interesting.
It's helpful. It's good that he doesn't have it, but yeah. The time will tell. We'll see where that case goes. There may be news on a bunch of cases. There may be news on a big lawsuit against a major bank that politically weaponized its access to discriminate against someone who did more for inner cities than almost any real estate investor in the country in the past 20 years. That may be news in the next week or two. So there's multiple cases coming with interesting information as part of that process. And so we'll see how it goes.
All right. And with that said, I think I'm going to go check a bunch of things behind me after this. But with that said, everybody, thank you all for tuning in. With the amount of news, I don't know if we're going to do a midweek stream this week, but there's a lot of stuff. And this was a jam-packed 2 hours and 7 minutes. We'll see what happens in the midweek, but same time next week. Everybody, thank you for the support. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for the engagement. And Robert, thank you as always. But do leave us with words of wisdom and optimism before we tune out.
So twofold. One, if you ever just want to sort of relax and chill, so like when I'm facing something frustrating or agitating, I'll tune into Viva Family. It's great. Like I didn't realize you could almost freeze Red Bull and it tastes better. That was intriguing. You get to see ostrich eggs, see the little guys do all their fun stuff. But it's also just reminder of the humanity, the greatest way to resist bad things in the world is to remember the good things and good people in the world. And that's why it's always great to partake and participate in. And then otherwise, as the GameStop revolution showed us, never forgive, never forget, hold the line, and sometimes you'll win.
All right, everybody. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, and we will see each other soon.